From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Hauntings of the English Lakes. There are many traditional ghost stories of hauntings of the English lakes. After the execution of the gallant and greatly beloved James Radcliffe, third and last Earl of Derwentwater, on February 24, 1716, it was affirmed that the water in Keswick Water, as Lake Derwentwater was then called, acquired temporarily a crimson hue, and that at night the sky glowed ominously with ensanguined streams. The phenomena were witnessed by many spectators, and have ever since been known as Lord Derwentwater's Lights. There was a strange tradition that prior to any calamity in the family of the Radcliffes, a tall figure, clad in grey robes, was seen on the shore of Derwentwater. The apparition appeared to the unfortunate Earl of Derwentwater, reproached him for his delay in joining the insurgents, and gave him a crucifix, which would render him proof against steel and bullets. The ghost of Lady Derwentwater, who has been unjustly accused of persuading her husband to take part in the rising of 1715, is said to have haunted Derwentwater for a time. The ghost of Ermengarde, a fair maiden who, for attempting to seduce a holy man, was doomed never to rest in her grave, is supposed to have haunted St. Herbert's Isle on Derwentwater for many years. The lakes and the neighboring hills in Cumberland, Westmorland, and North Lancashire were for many years believed to be abodes of enchanters and to be haunted by the ghosts of old Scandinavian settlers who appeared sometimes as warriors and sometimes as old white-haired chieftains and bards. Music played and sung by invisible beings used to be heard on the lakes and their lonely shores. According to Sir Walter Scott, the last of the Brownies, known as Ettrick Forest, haunted Bodsbeck, a wild and solitary spot near the head of Moffat Water. A spirit known in Cumberland as Hobthross used to haunt the lakes and neighboring old houses of that county. It was described as a meager, flat-nosed, shaggy, and wild, and is mentioned by Gervase of Tilbury in his writings. Cross fell in the lakes region, which is remarkable for the phenomena of the helm cloud upon the summit and the helm wind generated within it, was formerly known as Fiend's Fell, so dubbed from the popular belief that evil spirits haunted it. They were said to have been expelled by St. Augustine, who prayed and built an altar on the mountain. A slate or flag quarry, known as the Crier of Claife, long disused and overgrown with weeds, on the wildest and most lonely part of Ladderbarrow, which divides the valleys of Esthwaite and Windermere, above the ferry, was for a long time haunted by a very terrible apparition. Named the Crier, it was thought to have been exorcised permanently, but according to rumors current from time to time, the haunting occurs intermittently even yet. I referred more fully to it in one of my recent books. The North Lancashire Lake District abounds in stories of ghostly happenings. The following is one of them. One gloomy early autumn evening, a few young men who were in a very lively mood emerged from a country mansion, the ancient seat of the Montravers, bent on adventure and mischief. The moon had not yet risen, and only a few stars twinkling in a cloudless sky served to lighten their path. Here and there a light shone in the windows of such cottages who were not in bed, and nothing disturbed the silence save the barking of a dog and the distant tinkling of a sheep bell. "Where shall we go?" Vibert, one of the party, asked. "How about paying a visit to old Martha Young, the reputed witch? She is said to have a magic mirror, which reveals coming events, and to hold intercourse with the spirits that are rumored to haunt the lake close to which she lives. Let either go to her or to dance that the miller chap Overbury is giving to celebrate the coming of age of his pretty daughter, Doris." After debating for a while, he decided to visit Martha and perhaps go to the dance afterwards. Martha Young, who the superstitious people thought was a witch, lived in a wretched hovel within a few yards of one of the North Lancashire lakes. The roof of her habitation had nearly collapsed, and there was hardly a whole pane of glass in her windows. She appeared to be very old and to have no apparent means of obtaining a livelihood. She was never known to beg or to have received any help from the parish, and it was rarely that the people who came to have their fortunes told paid her anything. She was seldom seen to stir from her dwelling, and then it was only for the purpose of collecting sticks and bits of twigs for her fire. How she managed to exist was a mystery. Had she lived in the days of persecuting witches, she would probably have been tortured and burned to death or drowned. Vibert and his companions found her seated on a three-legged stool by a turf fire, surrounded by three black cats and an old sheepdog. She was tall and thin, her face haggard, her eyes large and sunk down deep in their sockets, and her whole appearance was repulsive and forbidding. On a small table near her were the remnants of a meal consisting of a few potatoes, crust of bread, and a small jug of water. She glared at the young men, and in a hoarse, masculine voice asked what they wanted. Vibert apologized for coming at such a late hour and said they would like her to tell them something about their futures, as they had heard that she possessed a magic crystal. Martha rose from her seat and peered closely into the face of each of the young men. Then, as if satisfied that they were not there to harm her, she said she would do as they wished, but begged them to obey her instructions, lest by not doing so, they would be harmed. They all promised implicit obedience to her commands. The abject poverty of the hovel made even the most thoughtless of them pity her. The furniture consisted of three stools, an old deal table, a few pans, some broken jugs, a wretched pallet with scarcely a rag to cover it, a few old musty books which lay in a corner, and a cauldron and a sack. Martha sat for a few minutes and then told them that she was going to utter a few incantations during which they must keep absolutely still and on no account interrupt her. She drew a circle on the floor with a piece of chalk, and in the middle of it placed a chafing dish filled with burning embers. On this she fixed the cauldron, which was half filled with water. She then bade those of the young men who had the courage to stand in the circle and join in the incantations. Only two of them, Vibert and Rankin, did as she requested. The others, who were far too frightened, stood as far as they could from the circle. The incantations having been uttered, Martha opened a sack and took from it a skeleton head, bones of various sizes, herbs, and the dead bodies of small animals, and threw them one by one into the cauldron, and while thus employed muttered words in a language unknown to any of her hearers. When the cauldron boiled, she put her fingers to her lips, enjoining them to keep perfectly still, and pointed to the wide open door beyond which lay the lake gleaming in the moonlight. Presently, the young men were thrilled to see two shadowy figures come from the lake, carrying a large crystal ball, which they placed outside the circle. Martha lifted it and set it in the center of the circle. She then asked Vibert if he really wished to see what the future had in store for him, and on his replying in the affirmative, she told them to peer steadily at the crystal. At first he saw nothing, and then suddenly he saw a counterpart of himself in the act of falling over a frightful precipice. The vision lasted for only a few moments, and when it had vanished, Martha asked Rankin if he wished to look in the crystal. He also expressed his readiness. He had not gazed at it for more than a few seconds before he saw it in his father, wearing his usual clothes and looking very ill. The crystal quickly clouded, and the figure resembling his father disappeared. Martha removed the cauldron, extinguished the fire, and bade the young men depart. "Before we leave," one of the young men said, "tell me if the lake is really haunted, and if the figures that I saw come from it in the crystal were really ghosts or merely illusionary." "If people around here say that the lake is haunted, let that suffice," Martha said. "Now go." Before the young men left, they gave her money. When they had gone a little distance from Martha's hovel, Vibert, who appeared to be very agitated, told his companions what he had seen in the crystal and wondered if it was just an illusion or hallucination or really due to the supernatural. One of the young men said that he had felt drowsy soon after Martha had put the cauldron on the fire and thought she must have put something in it to dope them. He said the figures he had seen coming from the lake looked very shadowy and unreal, just the kind of things that a person who had taken dope might see. Rankin said he thought that what he had seen in the crystal really was a vision, created, partly at least, by the spirits that haunted the lake. He declared that he had always had a very eerie feeling whenever he had been in close proximity to the lake. The young man kept arguing about the strange experience in Martha Young's hovel until they reached the spot where they were to disperse, some going one way to go home and some another. Within a week, Vibert fell over a cliff at her seaside resort on the west coast of England and was killed. About the same time as this fatality occurred, Rankin's father had a serious illness and died. The prophetic vision each of the two young men had seen the crystal was thus verified. Soon after the visit to Martha Young, she left the neighborhood. Whither she went, no one ever knew. The hovel, where she had lived for many years, was demolished, and both the site of it and the lake close to it were for a long time shunned after dusk, as gruesome lights and shapes were rumored to be seen there. The haunted rivers and waters of Wales. The River of Ghostly Stealth. The following account of a haunted river in Merioneth, related in the first person, is based on a story of an actual experience that was published in the Ladies' Cabinet in 1835. In the summer of 1832, I was on a walking tour in Wales. I was between Dolgelly and Bala when I was overtaken by a storm. The night was dark, the rain heavy, and the road so uneven, full of deep ruts and hilly, that I could only grope my way with difficulty. At every few yards, I either plunged into a miniature morass or, stumbling over a rock, found myself smarting in the center of a gorse bush. At length, I grew desperate. Human nature could stand it no longer, and resolving to perish with the cold rather than flounder on under such pitiable conditions, I threw myself on a boulder and prepared to lie there till daybreak. It is possible that I had remained in this position for 10 or 20 minutes when I was roused by the glow of a lantern, and starting up I saw confronting me the figure of a short man wrapped in a shaggy greatcoat and wearing a slouched hat. He was holding a lantern in his hand. By a series of pantomimic gestures he assured me that his intentions were amicable and that he was anxious to guide me to some place of shelter where I should have a more comfortable pallet than a bare rock. I accepted his offer, though not without some misgivings, as I could not remember ever having met anyone quite so uncouth and bizarre. Turning abruptly to the right, he struck across a wide moor covered with gorse and innumerable boulders, and so studded with pools that I seemed to be in a perpetual state of waiting. Emerging from this, I wended my way along the side of a precipice, at the bottom of which flowed a river. Beckoning me to follow, my guide mysteriously disappeared, and peering over the edge of the chasm, I perceived him, to my amazement, making his descent by an almost invisible and perpendicular pathway. For a second or so I hesitated, and then, making up my mind to brave anything rather than remain by myself in such an unfamiliar and dangerous neighborhood, I cautiously lowered myself over the brink, and after a few tumbles succeeded in overtaking him just as he arrived at the bottom. The valley in which I now found myself was bathed in a gloom and wrapped in a silence that was indescribably eerie. There was something thrillingly uncanny and sinister in the river which flowed past me, deep and dark, with a speed and stillness suggestive of horrible stealth. Close to the river were the ruins of a cottage singularly devoid of moss and lichens and any kind of rank vegetation. I tried to move away from the ruins, but some kind of weird, compelling force held me rooted to the ground. I appealed to my guide to aid me, but he made no response and stood rigid and silent, like a statue, on the bank of the river. Suddenly he removed his hat and revealed a white, mask-like face, utterly devoid of expression. For a few seconds he remained motionless, and then he glided over the river and vanished amid the gloom and shadows on the far side. Directly after this happened, returned to my limbs, and I lost no time in scrambling out of the awful valley. After walking several miles, I came to an inn where I was able to stay for the night. I learned next day from the landlord that the river and the ruins in the valley were well known to be very badly haunted. Before the cottage had fallen into a ruinous state, it had been occupied by a Mr. and Mrs. Evans. At the instigation of her husband, Mrs. Evans, a dark, handsome woman, flirted with a peddler known as Black Dave. She induced him to stay in the cottage, and when he was asleep, she sat on him while her husband cut his throat. They weighted his body with stones and threw it into the river. Within a week of their cruel deed, the cottage caught fire. Mrs. Evans was burned to death, and her husband, who was badly injured, only lingered long enough to make a full confession of their crime. It was soon after the burning of the cottage that rumors of ghostly happenings at the scene of the murders were circulated, and the valley acquired such an ill reputation that few people dared to venture in it alone after nightfall. Such was the tale that I heard, and at the conclusion of it, I left the inn and continued on my walking tour, only too thankful to leave the locality. The Fifth Stepping Stone. Richard Moore and his wife Laura were spending their summer holiday with friends in a small town in South Wales. They were walking along a pretty rural road a few miles from the town where they were staying when they suddenly saw a little boy a short distance ahead of them. He was about 8 years of age and was wearing a blue cloth roundabout, short jacket worn by children in the 30s and 40s of the last century. There was something about him, about his general appearance, and the way in which he walked that struck them as queer. They followed him to a stream which crossed the road, watched him walking on the big stones that spanned the water quickly and easily, as of use to them. Suddenly he disappeared. Fearing he had fallen into the stream, Richard ran to it, but there was not a sign of the boy, and the water was nowhere more than a foot or two deep. Had he fallen into it, he would only have wetted himself. He could hardly have been drowned. Much puzzled and wondering if the boy had been an hallucination, they crossed the stream. When they came to the fifth stepping stone, which was rather larger than the others, they both experienced a very uncanny sensation, as if there was a deep, dark, horribly dank pit under their feet. Directly they reached the sixth stone, the feeling went. Within a short distance of the stream was an inn, and feeling hot and tired, they had tea there. The landlady was a very pleasant, buxom woman, who, far from laughing when they told her about the boy, was extremely interested. "About 20 years before I came here," she said, "some people named Jones kept this inn. They had a little boy just like the boy you have described. He disappeared one day. The stream was very full at the time, and he was supposed to have fallen into it and been drowned. There was an old man named Davis living near here then, and when he heard about the missing boy, he suggested moving the fifth stepping stone, which had been loose for some time. This was done, and under where it had rested was a deep cavity, at the bottom of which was the body of the little boy, and a lot of bones, some of animals and others of human beings. The cavity was filled in, the stone replaced, and made secure. The stream had long been reputed to be haunted, and after the discovery of the boy's body's ghost was said to be seen crossing the stepping stones and always vanishing when it reached the fifth stone. The Valley of the River of Death. During their career as medical practitioners, doctors sometimes come in contact with the supernatural. It was so in the case of Dr. John Wells, who at the beginning of the present century had just bought a practice in a small town in Wales. Soon after his advent there, he was told by an old inhabitant of the town that he would not stay there long. Two of his predecessors had left before they had been there a year. When asked if they could explain the reason of their brief sojourn in the town, they would not say. There certainly did not appear to be any specific reason. There did not seem to be anything materially wrong with the house. It was well built and commodious, and there was nothing the matter with the drainage. It was pleasantly situated. The people were friendly, and the climate was no worse than it was in other parts of Wales. Yet there was something about it that they seemingly did not like. For the first 2 or 3 weeks after Wells had been there in his new home, nothing of any particular consequence happened. He liked the house. The rooms were a nice size and well ventilated. The walls and roof were watertight. The outlook pleasant. The people who he contacted were not very cordial, but on the other hand, they did not appear to be at all inimical, and he was looking forward to a long and very pleasant residence among them. He was sitting in front of the fire in his sitting room one evening, feeling very tired after working hard all day, when Squint, his fox terrier, who was stretched on the carpet by his side, suddenly growled and the telephone bell in the hall rang loudly. He got up, feeling queer, went to the hall, put the receiver to his ear, and inquired who was speaking. "It's I, Jill," a woman replied. "Come at once, darling. Something dreadful has happened." Wells had no idea who Jill was, but nevertheless, he put on his hat and coat, for the weather was cold, got his bicycle, and started off. He had as yet little knowledge of the neighborhood, but some strange impelling force guided him. He was himself, and yet not himself, and seemed to be in a queer, perplexing daydream. The road along which he cycled was narrow, rough, and little frequented. It was also very hilly. The scenery on either side of it was rugged and picturesque. A gentle descent led to a wooded valley, through which a river swollen by recent heavy rains flowed turbulently. There was something peculiarly weird in the sound. In the valley near the river was a white house. Dr. Wells entered the little garden in front of it, propped his machine against one of the walls, and rang the front doorbell. A woman answered it. She was young, with brown hair and lovely dark eyes. He somehow knew that she was Jill, and that he had known her intimately for some time. Everything about her and the house seemed extraordinarily familiar to him. He gazed longingly and admiringly at her. She was very pretty. He was not at all surprised when she said, "How kind of you, Charlie, to come here so promptly." "It's Henry," and Wells heard his voice saying. "Drunk again?" "He has been drinking, but he will never drink again. He is dead," Jill said, and then, with the ill-concealed joy in her eyes, "Come with me. He's in the dining room." She took him to a room in the rear of the house. Lying on his back on the floor was the body of a man of about 40 years of age. He was rather stout, with dark hair streaked with gray, blue eyes, and a mustache. Wells bent over him. The man smelt of whiskey. Apparently he had been drinking heavily, but it was not drink that killed him. He had been suffocated. Clenched between his teeth was a fragment of some brown material. Wells' eyes wandered from the man to Jill. On one side of her neck, there was a long red scratch, and a similar one on the back of one of her lovely white hands. "My dear little Siamese cat Topsy did those scratches, Charlie," she said, "and as she tried to bite me, I was obliged to have the poor thing put to sleep. I shall miss her dreadfully." She was wearing a brown dress with long sleeves, and Wells noticed that the cuff of one of the sleeves was torn. The dress was of the same color as the fragment of material in the dead man's mouth. Seeing the look of horror in his eyes and interpreting his thoughts, Jill gazed appealingly at him and said, "You still love me, Charlie, don't you?" "Yes," he replied hoarsely. "God forgive me, darling, I still love you." "You killed him, didn't you?" She nodded. "I had to kill him. I couldn't stand him any longer. He was a beast. For heaven's sake, don't let me be accused of murdering him. Can't you certify that he had a fit, or his heart was diseased?" Wells shook his head. "I'm afraid not. It would be too risky. I must try and think of something else." Although horribly shocked at what she had done, he was madly in love with her. Her beauty intoxicated him. He felt he would risk his reputation, life, and soul to save her from being arrested. "You look ill," she said. "I will get you some brandy." While she was out of the room getting the brandy, he happened to glance at a large mirror on one of the walls. He saw in it not the face of John Wells, who was fair and clean-shaven, but the face of a man with dark eyes and hair and a short black beard, a man who might have been several years older than Wells. He did not think it at all strange, and was neither startled nor surprised. He was looking at various other things in the room when Jill returned with the brandy. "I have an idea, Charlie," she said. "Will you help me to put the body in the river? The servants are out and won't be back till late. There is no one in the house but ourselves." Wells marveled at her calmness. She showed no emotion. "Someone passing by the house may see us," he said. "There is not much fear of that," she laughed. "Very few people pass the house in daytime, and fewer still after dark. People don't like this valley. They say the river is haunted. The local Welsh people are absurdly superstitious. Anyhow, we must take the risk, Charlie. And if you really love me, you will do anything to get me out of this jam. I don't at all relish the idea of being hanged." And she shivered. "I'll help you," Wells exclaimed. "Let me have a peep out of doors to make sure the coast is clear." "No, darling," Jill said. "I'll do that. You stay in the hall with the body till I come to you." They carried the body of the dead man into the hall and deposited it near the front door. Jill stole quietly out of the house and soon returned. "No one is about," she said. They carried the body to the river and threw it as far as they could into the raging, roaring water. There was something very horrible about the river. Wells could well imagine that it harbored dreadful spirits that tempted people to commit evil deeds. He was only too thankful when their task was done and they got back to the house. Jill insisted on him having more brandy. "How did you do it?" he inquired while they were sitting drinking. "He was lying on the floor," she said. "I got a cushion and put it on his face. He struggled and scratched me, but I am very strong, and he was too drunk to offer much resistance. I sat on the cushion till he ceased to move. He was dead when I took the cushion away. It was really quite easy, and I am only too glad I did it. I hated him, and it is a blessed relief to be free. There's not any fear of being found out, is there?" "I don't think so," Wells said. "Everyone knows he drank, and it will be thought that he walked into the river when he was drunk. There are no marks of violence on him, and if no one saw us with the body, I think we are safe." She threw her arms around his neck and kissed him. "You are a darling to help me, Charlie," she said. "I love you dearly. I have always loved you. I wish I could ask you to stay here tonight, but the servants will be back about 12. I gave them leave to stay out late, and it wouldn't look well if they found you here." She gave him more brandy in spite of his remonstrances, kissed him repeatedly, then saw him go. He felt rather fuddled when he mounted his machine, for he was not used to spirits and had never drunk so much brandy. The night had grown dark. Heavy clouds obscured the moon. A storm was brewing. The roaring of the haunted river and the thought of what was in it made him shudder. He pedaled hard to get out of the valley and was on the brink of a very steep descent when his lamp burnt out. He thought this odd because he remembered filling the lamp before he left home. He got off his machine, and when he looked at the lamp, he found it was not his. That made him look at the machine. This, too, was not his, but in the dark and in his fuddled state, he might easily have mistaken it for his own bicycle, as it was a very similar pattern. He asked himself how it could have happened. He knew the exact spot where he had put his machine when he got to the White House, and it was from that very spot he had taken this strange bicycle. No other bicycle was there. If it had been a bright night, a cyclist passing the house might possibly have looked in the garden and seeing his machine have effected an exchange. But something told him that no such thing happened, and that it was someone in the house who had taken his machine. And Jill had said the servants were out. No one was in the house but themselves. If that was really so, it looked as if it must have been Jill. But what was her motive? Was it merely because she had a sudden fancy for his bicycle? But it was a man's bicycle. Women did not ride men's bicycles, or did they? He was too fuddled to think. If the lamp went out, he would trust to luck to find his way home in the dark. There was little fear of meeting a policeman. He had never seen one on a Welsh country road at night, and very rarely in the daytime. He began to descend the hill, and he had not gone more than a yard or two before his lamp went out. His speed increased rapidly. He sought to check it, but to his dismay, the brake would not act. Faster and faster he went, the night air whistling in his ears. There was a sudden terrific impact with something hard and then a complete blackout. When he recovered consciousness, he found himself sitting before the fire in his sitting room, with Squint lying on the floor by his side. It took him some minutes to realize he was alive, and once again his own self, John Wells. The following day, he met an old gentleman named Allison, and to him he related his strange experience. "Of course it was only a dream," he said, "but it was extraordinarily vivid." Mr. Allison looked inquiringly at him. "Have you ever heard of Mrs. Martin and Dr. Charles Griffiths?" he asked. Dr. Wells shook his head. "Never." "Are you sure?" "Quite sure." "And you have never been to the valley which is known locally as the River Valley of Death because of the number of people found drowned in it?" "No, why?" "Because," Mr. Allison said, "you have just described it, a valley with a roaring river and a solitary white house. Rather more than 20 years ago, Mrs. Jill Martin lived in that house. Her husband, Henry Martin, was a jolly man, very popular in the neighborhood, but too fond of whiskey. He often came home drunk. Jill, who was partly French, was very pretty and had many admirers, among them Dr. Charles Griffiths, whose face you saw in the glass. He was about 45 years of age, with dark hair and eyes and a short black beard. You could not have described Jill and Charles more accurately if you had seen them in the flesh and blood. Martin was found drowned one day in the Valley River. It was much swollen at the time owing to recent heavy rain, and it was supposed that he had walked into it when he was drunk. About the time that this happened, Griffith met with a fatal accident. He was riding one of those high bicycles, the predecessors of the present-day safety machines. One dark night, and when descending a very steep hill, his brake would not act, with the result that he ran into a wall and was killed. After what you have told me, it looks as if Jill not only murdered her husband, but cunningly contrived to get Griffiths out of the way, too." "What happened to her?" Wells asked. "Oh, within a short time after Henry's death, she married a foreigner, sold her house, and went to South America. She did not survive her second marriage long, for she and her husband were drowned at sea."